Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
It is a great joy to be able to speak about this subject to you today, so Providence according to Plato and Aristotle. The careful study of the classics is a great preparatio evangelica, and not for nothing Clement of Alexandria stated that God, who spoke to Israel through the prophets and the law, spoke as well to the Gentiles through the philosophers. However, nowadays the study of the classics has been distorted, especially in this very important field of Aristotelian theology, which is what I mainly will present here today, along with Platonic theology. At the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th, a particular reading of Aristotle's theology, Sellers' reader, a German scholar, was imposed almost like a dogma, while the alternative reading defended by Brentano, but existing in a long tradition, was almost completely banned from academic publications. It has come back, however, to some extent. This banned reading is my reading because I see that it is the one that best explains Aristotle's writings and also the one that makes most sense. I am not alone here. I will mention, besides Brentano, who was the mentor of Husserl, the phenomenologist. So besides Brentano, Ralph McInerney and Thomas de Koning. I can send to you those of my papers that cover this subject and are now in English. I actually sent them to Terence already. Two of them. And I can also send some titles by those two great Catholics and Thomistic philosophers. I actually have like six papers on this and one book. But I have one more paper in English that I can send to you too. Yeah, okay. Let's start. I will proceed not as if I am trying to justify my reading in front of Aristotelian scholars who have accepted Sellers' reading. I will proceed rather in a way that can be clear for you, students, many of whom probably do not have previous philosophical or classical training. I'm not sure. Yeah. Okay. One, Platonic background. The kinds of experience that first suggest the existence of divine providence are very well explained in two Platonic dialogues, the Phaedo and the Timaeus. Let us focus on the Phaedo because it is the shorter and easier passage. See the handout text number one that I am not going to read but summarize here. It's a long text. I don't know if you have read the Phaedo. Many people read the Phaedo because it's the dialogue that he had with his students the day in which he was killed. It's very interesting. But I'm going to focus in a very particular passage. There, Socrates first criticizes the philosophers who came before him. He states that they did not know but the material cause and tried to explain everything mechanically. But it turns out that things cannot be explained mechanically. He gives the example of 1 + 1 = 2. That is, what is the cause of 2? Division, as when I break a piece of chalk in 2. So if I had a piece of chalk and I break it, then I have 2 pieces of chalk. Okay, so what is the cause of 2? That I broke that piece of chalk? Or putting together as when I put a piece of chalk by another one. Like there is one here, there is one there. I put them together, now there are 2. So in one case, because I joined them, there are 2. In the other case, because I broke them, there are 2. That's weird. What becomes 2? The first piece, the second, or the set? Socrates asks. He then gives other examples, such as nutrition, that illustrate that the whole is previous to its parts, qua parts, and has a reality that exceeds that of the parts, because without the assimilating principle, there is no nutrition. So it's not matter that is added to matter, it's something else. I can return to this issue during the questions and answers session. Where does that excess of reality come from? Socrates and Plato answer from the formal cause, which they think is separate from concrete things, the ideas. But how do the ideas come to be embedded in sensible things? Here they postulate an intellect. Socrates received this insight from Anaxagoras, as you can see in the first handout. The divine intellect has produced the material world having as its models the ideas, and as his goal to embed in place or matter the supreme idea, the idea of the good. So everything must have an order in which each thing is as it is for its own good and for the good of the whole. Socrates, Plato brings explicitly here the analogy of the human intellect, that of Socrates himself, who acts with the intellect, having in mind the good, what is just, and choosing it. Basing his action on the material cause. You know what? I'm going to explain this because... So the idea is, Socrates thinks there is a divine intelligence. He calls it the demiurge, which means the artisan. So he imagines that the artisan takes the matter and imposes on that matter the ideas, which that becomes the essence, for example, of a tree. The trees are made with matter and the idea of the tree, or the dogs with matter and the idea of the dog. And then Socrates thinks that the demiurge acts in a way similar to a craftsman. The craftsman takes, wood and makes or marble and makes a sculpture. So uses that matter and brings a form to it. And that, so he imposes on the matter his idea. And then he says, well, if God is a demiurge that acts in that way, he looks for the good of each part of that he makes. As an artisan who makes a table, for example, he makes the table. So the legs have a function, the surface has a function, and the table as a whole has a function, and the parts are directed to the function of the whole. So God should have acted like that, also the divine intellect, if the divine intellect is the cause of the cosmos. But then Socrates finds that divine intellect in Anaxagoras doesn't do anything, because Anaxagoras explains everything mechanistically as connections of material parts, very much as today our scientists do too, right? Okay, and then he says, well, Anaxagoras is funny because he explains that the divine intellect gave origin to the cosmos, but then he doesn't use the divine intellect. He's similar to a guy who says that Socrates acts with intellect, and then when you ask him, why is Socrates in prison? He replies, well, because he has sinews and muscles and bones, and they are together, and they form the legs and the knee, and he can articulate, and for that reason, Socrates can be sitting in prison. He says, no, that's not why he's sitting in prison, or why I am sitting in prison. I am sitting in prison because I had a chance to escape, but I chose not to, because I chose to obey the Athenians, because I thought that was the best thing to do, the just thing to do. So if I act with the intellect, the cause of my being here is a choice. And the cause of that choice is that it is good to stay here. It's the just thing to do. So you cannot say that I act with the intellect and then answer the question, why am I here, saying that it's because I have material parts. That's the comparison that Plato introduces. So this is a very rich passage. That's the passage that I gave there. We must reflect on it carefully. If the whole is not reducible to its parts, then the mechanistic explanation about its being cannot be sufficient. If the whole has a level of... So, for example, nutrition is not the addition of matter to matter. When the dog eats and grows, it's not just because matter is added to matter. If he didn't have a principle of unity, he couldn't be nourished. He couldn't grow. There has to be a principle of unity that transforms the food into parts of his body. So the whole is previous to the parts. The principle of unity of the whole is previous to the parts. So, if the whole has a level of operation that exceeds that of its parts, then a principle of its being different from the parts must exist. Let's think, for example, of living beings. Life and the operations of living beings, qua living, are not reducible to chemistry. If they were, biology would disappear and it would be absorbed by chemistry. But if this is so, there must be a principle beyond the parts from which the excess reality of the living being comes from. Moreover, the living being has unity. In it, there is unity and there is multiplicity. But a dog is really a whole, and he is not a whole like a car is a whole. He is a substantial whole. In him, in the dog, there is this level of operations, biological, that are not reducible to merely chemical reactions. In the car, there is nothing of the sort. This is why the car is constructed while the dog is generated. So in the dog, there must be a principle of its unity and of its being beyond the parts. Now, because dogness is in all the parts, that principle of being must be whole in each part. That is possible because the principle is simple and therefore does not really have a location except per actions. One can say that it is located in the body that has existence and life thanks to it. When the dog is conceived, it has plurality of parts, the dog, but it is really one body, one being. During all his life, he is one being. But when he dies, then what remains is not one body, it is a corpse, a conglomerate of substances without unity. So the principle of unity and of life or being, because for the dog to live and to be are the same, is present during the whole life of the dog. And it is whole in each part of the dog, making it to be a part and not, say, water or carbon. Because in the body of animals, you have water and carbon. But while the animal is alive, they are actually parts of his body. They are not water or carbon, except in potency. What is that principle that makes the dog be a dog and be whole? It is the formal cause. Plato thought that such cause was a participation in the idea of dogness. But Aristotle corrected this and said that such principle is precisely what we call soul. Now, if natural bodies have this kind of formal principle that transcends the mechanistic principles, material elements, and their mutual agencies, and if the living operations, such as seeing, require the life of the animal that operates, that sees, without the animal that sees, there is no sight, then one cannot reduce the act of seeing to its material basis, the eye, the retina, the brain. Like physiology is saying, well, vision in the dog is this thing that happens in his brain. But that's not true, because if you don't have a dog as an animal, a whole, that is alive and actually is the subject of that seeing, there is no sight. And if seeing is not reducible to a material basis, then how can I say that the organs of seeing do not serve that power that transcends them? How can I claim that seeing is nothing but an epiphenomenon of the mechanistic connections between its material parts? That would be ridiculous. That is what Socrates is saying in that first text of the handout. The pre-Socratics, like many of our contemporaries, were blind to a kind of cause that is very much real, the formal cause. But for the same reason, they are blind to the final cause. If the reality of sight exceeds the mechanistic relations between its material parts, it is impossible to hold that such parts do not serve a function. Because they do serve a function, the Greeks call them organs, organa, instruments. In Greek, organon means instrument. Now, if there is formal cause in natural things, that means that there is something intelligible, something that can be signified in a human world, something proportionate to our intellect and to any intellect embedded in matter. How is that possible if there isn't an intellect that was the author of nature? So a dog is material, but it's a dog. That means it has an essence. And that essence we can pronounce with a name, dog. And the name is not just a wing that comes from my mouth. Because in Spanish, we don't say dog, we say perro. And in French, they say chien, and well, etc. We are saying the same thing, although the words are different. Because the children, when they learn to speak in different languages, they are grasping the essence. So that's why you can have translation, because there is an essence. And that's very mysterious. How is it possible that in matter you have something that can be grasped by an intellect? So what Socrates says, that's possible because an intellect is the origin of that. That's what he says. Moreover, if besides intelligibility, so something that can be grasped with the intellect, there is final cause, and if nature seeks that final cause, but nature is not intelligent, as the nature of the dog is not, then that intellect that is the author of nature must have instilled in nature that tendency towards the final cause. Since all natural beings have similar tendencies, the whole natural world was by the Greeks called cosmos. Cosmos means the ordered world. That intelligence is what Plato called the demiurge, comparing his action to that of the human artisan. And this is what appears in the passage from the Phaedo. There you see a connection between the new Socratic understanding of nature and the new Socratic reflection on man. Because he sees that mechanistic explanations are not sufficient for nature and neither for man. Because it would be absurd to say that he's in prison because he has bones and muscles, etc. Yeah. They are intimately connected. You find an intelligible dimension in nature that directs our gaze towards an intelligent author. And you understand that intelligent author in light of human craft. So each work of the demiurge must be directed towards something good that has been understood as an end in the same way that the good human artisan directs each of his works to an end. If so, the whole natural world as the work of God, the demiurge, is directed by God towards its end. Okay, that's the first section. Two, from Plato to the physics of Aristotle. Plato's insights were closely followed by Aristotle in the second book of the Physics. I will transcribe here some relevant passages directly from the Physics with a brief explanation, and then some passages from Aquinas' commentary. And then we will connect all this with Aquinas' ways to prove the existence of God. Let's start with Physics 2:8. I am not going to read it now, but you have it in the handout text number 2. I was going to read, but it's a bit complicated, so we'll read the explanation. This passage is remarkable. The text number 2 is remarkable. In it, Aristotle first states that nature acts for the sake of something with a final cause, similarly to Plato, although with an important difference that I will point out later. Second, Aristotle criticizes the pre-Socratic philosophers in general who missed this kind of cause and postulated only mechanistic causes. But third, he criticizes Empedocles and Anaxagoras in particular in a way very similar to the way in which Plato criticized Anaxagoras, as you can see in the first handout taken from the Phaedo. So he said Anaxagoras introduced the intellect as a cause of the cosmos, Plato says, but he never uses then that intellect. He explains everything through material causes. Well, Aristotle does the same thing with Anaxagoras and Empedocles in that passage that I didn't read. So if they mention other causes, Anaxagoras and Empedocles, says Aristotle, then the mechanistic one, they just touch it and they say goodbye to it, says Aristotle in the text. So what is the difference between Plato and Aristotle on this point? The difference is that Plato immediately comes to the ultimate cause. So he says the origin of that final causality is God. Aristotle doesn't do that. Aristotle stops at the immediate cause. What do I mean? Aristotle does not state immediately here that God's intellect is the demiurge of the cosmos, but that nature acts for the sake of something. Nature acts for the sake of something. So nature is a kind of being that is not God, but acts for the sake of something. It is teleologically constituted. This is why Aristotle neatly distinguishes between physics, natural science, and first philosophy, while in Plato the limits are blurred. What I mean is this, Plato immediately jumps to God. Aristotle says no. There is final cause, and the immediate cause of that is the nature of the dog. Like, for example, I don't know, like Chomsky says, the small children have a natural tendency to language. Why? Because with very, very few trial and mistake and correction, they form the whole grammar. That's impossible without natural tendencies. Well, what's the origin of those tendencies? Nature. Aristotle would say nature. You know, we have natural tendencies. Water freezes at 0 degrees, which is tautological, well, Celsius. Well, what's the cause of that? Water's nature, etc. Okay. However, so that's why Aristotle says there is a science of nature, which is physics. And then there is another science different from physics, which is theology, which can study the ultimate cause of those tendencies. But he doesn't jump immediately to God. That's what I'm trying to say. However, when Aquinas comments on this passage, although he accepts and respects the distinction of disciplines between physics and theology, he had something very relevant for our present point. In lesson 12, number 1, or lecture 12, number 1 of his commentary on book 2, see hand out text number 3, that I'm going to read. Aquinas says, Aristotle says, therefore, first that it must be pointed out that nature is among the number of causes which act for the sake of something. And this is important with reference to the problem of providence. So Aquinas says, nature is the cause, but this is important for providence. So he takes the next step. For things which do not know the end, do not tend toward the end unless they are directed by one who does know, as the arrow is directed by the archer. Hence, if nature acts for an end, it is necessary that it be ordered by someone who is intelligent. This is the work of providence. Okay, so the fact that nature is teleological is relevant for the consideration of the problem of providence. Is this an undue interference with Aristotle's secular philosophy as a contemporary to us would anachronistically object? No, it is not. That issue is precisely in Aristotle's mind at the very moment in which he's writing those lines that Aquinas is commenting on. How do I know that? Well, by reading the problem that Aristotle immediately poses, the lines that he immediately writes after the ones that I didn't read. So, he says in text number 4 of the handout, this is Aristotle. So here the aporeal problem arises of what prevents us from saying that nature acts neither for the sake of something nor because it is better, but rather that Zeus drops the rain, not to make the corn grow, but of necessity, for the rising vapor must needs be condensed into water by the cold and must then descend, and incidentally, when this happens, the corn grows. Zeus drops the rain, says Aristotle. Metaphor or not, this proves that the issue of providence is in Aristotle's mind here. We will see why in due course. Afterward, Aristotle provides very solid arguments to prove that there is final cause in nature and that to deny it equates to deny the existence of nature itself. At the end, he gives a very powerful argument to disarm the counter-arguments. He points out that in spiders and ants, which clearly have no intellect, one can easily see how their behavior is teleological. In this context, you must place the handout, text number 5, which I am not going to read. I wanted to read it, but I'm not going to read it, because otherwise it will be too long. The text is very rich about ants and spiders. To unpack it, let us listen to Aquinas' commentary. See the handout, text number 6a. And this is Aquinas. Next, where Aristotle says it is absurd, he destroys the third point by which some hold the opinion that nature does not act for the sake of something. For it seems to some that nature does not act for the sake of something because nature does not deliberate. But the philosopher, that's how he calls Aristotle, the philosopher says that it is absurd to hold this opinion. For it is obvious that art acts for the sake of something, yet it is also obvious that art does not deliberate, nor does the artisan deliberate insofar as he has the art, but insofar as he falls short of the certitude of the art. Text 6a. Hence, the most certain arts do not deliberate, as the writer does not deliberate how he should form letters. If you had to deliberate every time you're going to write a letter, you couldn't write. Moreover, those artisans who do deliberate after they have discovered the certain principles of the art do not deliberate in the execution. Thus, one who plays the harp would seem most inexperienced if he should deliberate in playing any chord. And from this, it is clear that an agent does not deliberate, not because he does not act for an end, but because he has the determinate means by which he acts. Hence, since nature has the determinate means by which it acts, it does not deliberate. So spiders do not deliberate. That doesn't mean that they don't act for an end. That just means that... So that doesn't mean that. And how does Aristotle or Aquinas show that? Both of them do that. They say, well, the artisan does not deliberate either. And that doesn't mean that he doesn't act for an end. Like when you are writing, you want to express your thought, that's an end. You are writing for the sake of something, but you don't deliberate what you are going to write. When you are walking, you are going to a place, but you don't deliberate how you are going to move the feet, because when you learn to walk when you were 1 year old, or earlier, or, I don't know, or later, doesn't matter. At that time, you deliberated. You were thinking how to do it, but once you acquire the habit, you don't need to deliberate how to do it. The same thing with speaking, etc. Yeah. Here you have the first point in Aristotle's text. The fact that nature does not deliberate does not imply that nature does not act for the sake of an end. Then Aquinas adds, see the handout text 6b, for nature seems to differ from art only because nature is an intrinsic principle and art is an extrinsic principle. For if the art of shipbuilding were intrinsic to wood, a ship would have been made by nature in the same way as it is made by art. And this is most obvious in the art, which is in that which is moved, although per accidents, such as in the doctor who cures himself. For nature is very similar to this art. So nature is very similar to the doctor that uses the art of medicine, heals himself. Because plants gather the nutrients and then they grow and they shoot the leaves and flowers and then the fruit, etc. Because there is this intrinsic order in them. Nature is this cause that has this teleology in itself. This is the second point. Nature is different from art, not because it does not act for the sake of an end, but because it moves its subject from within. And now we can come to the third and culminating point made by Aquinas, which is a corollary not explicit in Aristotle's text. See the handout text number 6c. Hence, it is clear that nature is nothing but a certain kind of art. It is the divine art impressed upon things by which these things are moved to a determinate end. It is as if the shipbuilder were able to give to timbers that by which they would move themselves to take the form of a ship. This example is in Aristotle exactly like that. The example is from Aristotle in the text I didn't read. You can read it there. It is true that Aristotle does not add that tendency exists because of divine art. Aristotle doesn't add that. But it is also true that he has laid down all the principles that allow to draw this conclusion, which he actually draws in his Metaphysics, Books Lambda, chapter 10, which is in line with Plato's Phaedo and Timaeus, but with the important difference that I pointed out. Aristotle does not jump from teleology to divine agency. He deems necessary to go from teleology to the proximate cause, nature, in this way leaving space for natural science as a distinct discipline separate from natural theology. So he takes the step that Aquinas is showing here, but not in the physics, but in the metaphysics. Okay. Three, from the physics to the fifth way to prove the existence of God, which is Aquinas' way. But the time is ripe to see the use that Aquinas makes of these principles in his fifth way to prove the existence of God. The text is the following. See the handout text number 7. The fifth way is taken from the governance of the world. We see that things which lack intelligence, such as natural bodies, act for an end. And this is evident from their acting always or nearly always in the same way, so as to obtain the best result. Hence, it is plain that not fortuitously, but designedly, Do they achieve their end? Now, whatever lacks intelligence cannot move towards an end unless it be directed by some being endowed with knowledge and intelligence, as the arrow is shot to its mark by the archer. Therefore, some intelligent being exists by whom all natural things are directed to their end, and this being we call God. Okay, notice well that Aquinas speaks of the movement of the government of the world, and he states that we know about it because things have ends. Is Aquinas applying here the argument from design? This is an important question, and the answer is no, he is not. The difference between this way and the so-called argument from design is similar to the difference between Aristotle's way of dealing with final causes and Plato's way. Aquinas does not state that because there is teleology in the world, we must conclude that there is a designer that has built the world as a clockmaker makes a clock. The supporters of intelligent design, starting with William Paley in the 18th century, hold a mechanistic view of nature. For this reason, they see God as the immediate cause of the teleological tendencies, in a way similar to that in which the clockmaker is the cause of the teleological movement of the clock. Aquinas realizes that there is a necessary intermediate step, nature. Nature is a real cause that explains the teleological movement of animals, plants, and inanimate beings. But that cause cannot be the ultimate cause. The ultimate cause must be an intelligent being, God. I will leave with Terence a paper on the fifth way where you can see all the nuances here contained. I already sent it. But this distinction that separates Aquinas from the authors, the whole intelligent design, is what allows him to reply to the second objection to the existence of God in Article 3, Question 2 of the first part of the Summa Theologiae. Here is the objection. See handout text number 8. It is superfluous to suppose that what can be accounted for by a few principles has been produced by many. But it seems that everything we see in the world can be accounted for by other principles, supposing God did not exist. For all natural things can be reduced to one principle, which is nature, and all voluntary things can be reduced to one principle, which is human reason or will. Therefore, there is no need to suppose God's existence. This is very contemporary, this argument, by the way. Here you can see the famous Occam's knife, which clearly is not Occam's, sorry. But besides that, you see, because Occam is posterior, but besides that, you see that the preoccupation about the reality of the object of natural science and implicitly about the autonomy of science. But Aquinas' answer will be that although science and proximate causes have their own territory, first philosophy and ultimate causes have their own territory as well. See the handout text number 9, which is the reply to that objection. Since nature works for a determinate end under the direction of a higher agent, whatever is done by nature must needs be traced back to God as to its first cause, which is the same as the ultimate cause from the other perspective. Michael Behe, one of the defenders of intelligent design, states that his argument in favor of intelligent design, which had been formulated by Pierre-Paul Grasset in the 70s, by the way, against the synthetic theory of evolution, means that intelligent design is a scientific truth. This is a total epistemological confusion. Aquinas well distinguishes between proximate causes and first or ultimate cause, and between natural science and natural theology, unlike Behe. 4, the modern rejection of final causes or of natural teleology. Of course, nowadays, the classical atomistic argument seems to clash with the prevalent opinion that there are no final causes in nature. But is this prevalent opinion true? It is not. It has been successfully contested by contemporary philosophers such as George Molnar in his book Powers, a Study in Metaphysics, published in 2003 by Oxford University Press, which is a refutation of the Humean position and a defense of the Aristotelian position. What Molnar demonstrates is that if there is natural science, it is because natural things have natures and therefore powers that behave in a regular manner. But precisely because there are powers, there are expected and anticipated behaviors in natural things. Water freezes at certain temperature and boils at another. Combustion needs oxygen. Iron melts at certain temperature, etc. Those are tendencies precisely towards final causes, Of course, Humeans have tried to deny that there are powers in natural things, but Molnar reduces their arguments to absurdity. Molnar's argumentation is a replay of Aristotle's in the Physics. Aristotle had already replied to similar objections. There, Aristotle explains that there are three kinds of general efficient causes: nature, intelligence, and chance or fortune. We know that there is nature because some changes and processes occur regularly. So we grasp that nature and intelligence act for the sake of something. I don't know, in spring plants shoot new leaves and then flowers, etc. And that every year the same thing happens. And then in the fall, the leaves change color and they fall, etc. So nature, there are regularities that allow us to see that there is an underlying cause, and that's what we call nature. So nature and intelligence act for the sake of something. Nature with regularity. Intelligence sometimes with regularity, like in most operations of art, but sometimes without regularity. Chance and fortune result from the unintended crossing of natural or intelligent causal paths. For example, I find by chance a treasure in my garden in Florida because I am digging with the end of putting up a fence. But in the 16th century, a Spanish gentleman in Florida had buried a treasure to prevent its being robbed by a pirate. Or, Toby lies down with the aim of resting, but a bear discharges for his own health, leaving Toby blind. So, fortune and chance are causes per actions and totally depend on causes per se. To deny that there is final cause is to deny that there is regularity in nature and therefore a cause per se. That is to say, it equates to deny that there is nature. Water could not freeze at the usual temperature. Stones could be not attracted by planet Earth, etc. And that, of course, is what Hume does. He actually denies that there is nature. But to deny that there is nature is to deny what is evident and the very existence of natural science. So Hume's philosophy, far from being the philosophy of natural science, is a philosophy incompatible with natural science. 5. Plato's Laws. The best classical text to unfold the implications of what we have said is the 10th book of Plato's Laws. So the point here, I'm just going to say and then jump because it's getting a bit long. So he proves in the 10th book that God exists and that God takes care of human beings, and that God cannot be placated with sacrifices. That's the subject of the 10th book. So I jump a little bit. Aristotle is much more parsimonious than Plato. However, we have texts that receive the gist of these Platonic ideas. Thus, Aristotle teaches that the man who lives according to virtue is happy and loved by the gods, and the man who commits injustice is truly wretched. Okay, the point is this. So Plato, the most difficult problem in natural theory, I would say, is that the Greeks realized that God must be immobile. Immobile, you say, or immobile? Immobile. But if God is immobile, how can he take care of the contingent affairs of human beings? So in the Laws, what Plato replies is, well, God gives us a nature such that with bad actions, our nature becomes wretched, and with good actions, our nature becomes happy, and that is true in this life and also after death, more clearly after death, he says. So he tries to devise a way to harmonize the immutability of God with God taking care of human beings. And he proposes a way in the Laws. Aristotle does the same thing. So he says, the man who lives accordingly to virtue is happy and loved by the gods, and the man who commits injustice is truly wretched, according to the natural order of things. But besides this, there is an elliptic but clear text about how the divine intellect establishes order in the whole cosmos, and especially among those beings that are closer to God due to the hierarchy of their nature. Such text is Metaphysics 12:10, which I cannot read now, but you can find in your handout as text 11. I jump over text 10, which is the Laws. 6. Direct divine intervention in history. Having established In this general way that there is providence, since God inscribes order and teleological tendencies within nature, let us take a further step. Does God take care of human beings beyond the teleology intrinsic in nature, such that he can intervene in history in a direct way? Aristotle's answer is yes. Aristotle demonstrates to us that God, of course, takes care of human beings, very especially in the sublunary world, and even more especially takes care of those that strive to be wise and prudent, and of those who are truly fortunate and loved by him. God does this with an action that is not natural, but rather intelligent. It is an efficient causality, since this action is a species of counseling, and any counseling he identifies in the physics as an example, the first example of efficient causality. The relevant text is contained in the Eudemian Ethics, which I will not read today, but later I will highlight and explain some of its central points. It's a handout, text number 12. I will not read it. What Aristotle has in mind here is the flow of our consciousness, and it's being pointed towards a certain direction, towards deliberating, for example. What leads our consciousness from not deliberating to deliberating? Whence arises the desire to deliberate? Is it the mere happening of a physical stimulus and of the contingent presence of a sensible reality, as for animal desires in general? It is said in the Senso Animalium, chapter 6, for example. Would not chance in this case rule our life? Aristotle establishes in Eudemian Ethics that God is the initiator of all good deliberations that are not due to chance. So this means this. During the day, we are thinking of, I don't know, flowers and birds and whatever, right? While we walk to class. And then suddenly, we have an idea. This afternoon, I have to make a decision whether this afternoon I go to the domestic institute or not, for example, right? And then you start to deliberate. Will I go or not go? And then you come to a decision. The happy decision, you came. Okay. And then Aristotle says, that either happened through chance, but because all our thoughts, our stream of thoughts are chaotic, right? Chaotic. He says, if the good deliberation was the fruit of chance, then our life would be just delivered to fortune. So that's not possible. So he says, God actually initiates the important deliberations, especially of those who are wise. That's not left to chance, according to Aristotle. This allows him a bit forward in the text to state that God is the initiator of the divinely fortunate man's decision without upsetting his conception of the general order of the cosmos. God's special intervention in the case of the divinely fortunate man does not run against the natural order. I am confident Aristotle had in mind here the experience of men such as Timoleon. Timoleon, this remarkable politician, was certainly a fortunate man, but he was with equal certainty a prudent and wise man. He's crossing the strait from Italy to Sicily, and his strategic campaign for the overthrowing of the Sicilian tyrants and the defense of Syracuse against the Carthaginian forces were deeds in which, after doing all that prudence required, he also leapt into the unknown with surprising success. It is no accident that Aristotle mentions navigation and strategy as examples of the presence of fortune in human affairs. I am coming to the end. There were similar insights in some of Plato's works, such as Ion and Mino and Republic. And of course, one finds in Herodotus, Polybius, and Plutarch that the Greeks and the Persians truly believed in direct intervention of the gods in history. Without consulting the oracles, nobody went into battle. Aristotle has a work on divination in sleep. There, he not only does not prima facie exclude that God could be the cause of divinations in sleep, but he states that God's causality is the only plausible explanation in case there is real divination in sleep. So he explicitly accepted the possibility of this kind of divine intervention. But besides all this, Aristotle explicitly held that without divine intervention from the sun's sphere, human generation cannot be completed. Our intellect being corporeal, it cannot come from the reproductive matter that man and woman contribute. Seven, and final section, very short, the question of miracles. There is still a further question that we could ask. Can the intervention of God take the form of a suspension of the laws of nature or of an action totally unexplainable with the laws of nature, the form of a miracle, strictly speaking, according to the classics, causing the being of an incorporeal substance such as the noetic soul is already an action that is unexplainable with the laws of nature alone. Actions similar to this one have been accepted by the classics as possible. Multiplying the bread might be a different issue because it involves the creation of matter. I am not sure the classics would have accepted the creation of matter. Although it does not collide with the principles of their philosophy, it might have collided with their preconceptions concerning the reducible principles of the cosmos, which according with Aristotle were God and matter, and according with Plato were the ideas God and matter. Now, the suspensions of the laws of nature, such as the conversion of bread and wine into Christ's body and blood, or the conception of a child by two old and sterile human beings, such as Sarah and Abraham, or the resurrection of a dead person, as those walked through Elijah, or by Christ, I do not recall any text that I could adduce as an instance of the possibility of such things in the classics' works. I am not saying there is not such text. I am just saying that I do not recall an instance. If you are interested on the substance of this subject, you should read John Henry Newman's two responses to the critique of miracles by David Hume and other infidels. I can't present here the arguments, but I will leave a larger version of the lecture for you to have. Maybe you have it already, I don't know. In the handout, however, you can see text 13 to 15, which contain the argumentative yeast of both sides, Hume and Newman. Newman's point is that the whole strength of Hume's argument comes from presupposing his bad metaphysics. And with this, I come to the end of my lecture. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.